Welcome to the GeoMob Podcast, where we discuss geo-innovation in any and all forms, whether for fun or profit.
Hello, and welcome back to another GeoMob Podcast episode. Today, I'm speaking with my friend and colleague, Jeff Smith. In fact, Jeff gave me my first job after my PhD, working on the UK Land Cover Map 2000 project. That's going back a bit. And it's land cover that we want to discuss today as well. Jeff, welcome to the podcast, and I look forward to chatting through all sorts of things related to land cover, particularly around some of the European products.
Great.
Excellent. So maybe for the benefit of the listeners, could you sort of let us know what your background is in geospatial?
Okay, right. Thanks. Thanks for having me on the show. I started off by being sort of more of a physical geographer. So I had a background in environmental science and geophysics. And it was only at sort of postgraduate level that I then got into Earth observation through studying at the Dundee MSc, as it was at the time, and then going to Swansea to do a PhD on imaging spectroscopy. So I've covered quite a lot of ground in terms of when I was doing my MSc, I used sort of weather satellite data in a very near real time or slightly operational application. But then when I went to my PhD, it went to real sort of cutting edge at the time, hyperspectral monitoring of vegetation canopies. But then I kind of left that behind and went back to what was perhaps more bread and butter work, you might have said, for Earth observation. I started working on the UK land cover map projects. But we were actually doing some new developments there. And so I developed an approach using an object-based approach rather than pixel-based, so we could then capture fields, rivers, woodlands, etc. in the landscape, and then classify them as individual objects and then provide additional attribution to those. So we were sort of really stretching what could be done with Earth observation at the time. So that was...
I remember whilst I was sort of doing little bits of digitizing, you were in a room sort of doing C++ coding of yeah, object-oriented stuff, which at the time was pretty, you know, pushing the boundaries, I think.
Yeah, that was pre-eCognition for those who use object-based image analysis software. And so we used some software for a company called LaserScan, or the OneSpatial they're called now in Cambridge. So they were really ahead of the game then in object-oriented database technology. So I think we probably were the first national scale object based land cover map that was produced. Everyone else was still doing pixel based approaches at the time.
That's very cool. And now you work for yourself, is that correct?
Yeah, so, 14, 15 years ago now, I decided to set up my own company and do consulting very much still in the land monitoring domain, focusing mainly on satellite-based optical analyses. So I've then provided quite a lot of input into the European developments around the Copernicus Land Monitoring Service and various aspects associated with that, which I think we'll talk of later in this program.
Yeah, definitely. So are you still writing code in C++? Or?
No, I've kind of I hand that over to other people now. From coding developed much faster than I did, and so it kind of left me behind. And I'm quite happy to sit there and come up with ideas and get someone else to code them up now.
That sounds like the right way around, definitely, yeah. So I know of Careen, which is a land cover data set that covers Europe, and I know that it's been around for a while. So I guess my main question is it still a key land cover data set? Is it something that people should be looking at and should be using? Because I've had quite a few conversations recently with people who are interested in sort of localized land cover data, and they're talking about, well, how do we generate our own land cover? And I quite often point them at existing data sets like Careen or the land cover map in the UK, because there's a whole raft of work that's gone into creating those, and I feel they should be used a lot more. So,
Yes, definitely. I mean, probably best if I just explain a bit of the background to Careen. So
that'd be great.
I mean, it seems a long time ago now, but it actually started being developed in 1985. And Careen, as we have acronyms through everything we do, but Careen stands for Coordination of Information on the Environment. And it was actually a much bigger program. And the Careen land cover map was kind of only one part of that, but that seems to be the part that has remained. And so that was the first version effectively was produced for a kind of reference period around 1990, from 1985 to 1990. And it carries some interesting information from the time that it was produced. So it's a 1 to 100,000 scale product, and it has a minimum mapping unit of 25 hectares. And the reason that was there was because at the time, the satellite images were actually printed out as hard copies. Acetates were put over the top. And then in a 25-hectare area, you could just about write the three-digit code of the Careen nomenclature. So that became the sort of restriction on what could be mapped. Obviously, then over time, it's evolved, and now it's done with on-screen digitization, or in some countries, they take a national map and then generalizes through to the Careen standards. But some of these things have had to perpetuate so that there's back compatibility with the previous products. And in terms of the strengths of it, I think that is one of the key points, that it's been around since 1990. There's been iterations of various intervals of 10 to 6 years during that period. So it's actually one of the few data sets that is highly consistent and has a long time period for this sort of thing. And it gives wall-to-wall European coverage. So in those respects, I think it is an important data set to consider. But like you said as well, that with having a 25-hectare minimum mapable unit, it doesn't really work so well at the local level. And that's kind of one of the restrictions. So, there's examples of small urban areas, like villages, etc., in the countryside. They disappear from Careen because they're not big enough to be mapped. Then that has a knock-on effect then if you're then trying to, say, distribute a population across an area, you find that you don't actually have the urban centres there to put those population values in. So
I guess there's both the sort of scientific impact of that, whereby, exactly like you say, you can't put the numbers to a given class, but also there's the political ramifications of someone suddenly looking at a map and finding that their urban area has disappeared.
Completely. And I think there's we won't really touch on them today, but there's some other products that were produced as part of the Copernicus Land Monitoring Service that were particularly there to address that, like a soil sealing product, which was delivered at 20 or 10 meter pixels. And so the idea there was to say, okay, even though these things don't appear in Careen, we at least know there's some urban area there in the form of sealed surfaces, etc., artificially sealed surfaces. And so that was a kind of stopgap to try and sort of compensate for this fact that things were missing.
Yeah. Your mention of the Copernicus Land Monitoring System there actually is a brilliant segue into the next sort of area that I was interested in, because I've always known Careen as being part of Copernicus, or at least as far as I can remember, it's always been part of Copernicus. But obviously Copernicus has come subsequent to Careen being around.
Yeah.
Would you be able, for the listeners, just to sort of summarize what Copernicus is? I know it's huge and very broad, but maybe summarize that and just explain sort of what the land service is and why Careen has been pulled into that.
Very quickly, so Copernicus is the European Earth Observation Service, and it has three main components. One is the actual satellite component, so the Sentinels that people are probably familiar with. The other is services, which are producing geospatial information, mainly based on the Sentinels, but not exclusively. Some of them are based on other satellite or ground data measurements. And then finally, kind of, there's an in situ component, which is quite minor, but is still very important, particularly in certain of the services that require a heavy calibration component. And then the services are broken down by theme, and I hope I can remember all of them. So there's land, there's marine, there's a security service, there's climate change, emergencies, and another one, have I already said atmosphere? But anyway, they're kind of general themes around particular topics, and so that gives them a focus. And so the Copernicus Land Monitoring Service itself has effectively three components embedded within it. There's a global one for mapping global parameters on the, of the land, and then more of a continental one, which does wall-to-wall European mapping, and a final one, which they call... they change the name occasionally, or hotspots or priority areas, they call them, which focus on things like, say, maybe large urban areas or coastal zones or riparian zones. And so they have products focused on those. So, yeah, I'd recommend going to the Copernicus website and then drilling down to the service which is the most appropriate for you, rather than me try and explain this really complicated, multi-layered sort of approach that goes on there.
I guess as well that if you're working in sites or countries within Europe that where you require information, be it about land or atmosphere or climate change or whatever, then Copernicus is also the number one place you should sort of be going for data. That's the flagship for the EU. I'm guessing it's funded by the EU, but maybe not.
Yes, yeah, it's funded by the EU, and the ESA provides some input, mainly with the satellite component. So some ESA resources going to build in the Sentinels and managing them when they're in orbit. It's an interesting point that I think is perhaps. Hopefully changing at the moment, but you and I, Alistair, probably come from a community which would start from first principles and, you know, collect satellite imagery and then process them and produce products. But now we have such a rich amount of geospatial data out there already derived from satellite imagery that we don't have to always go back to square one. And a European project I'm working on at the moment called EU Grassland Watch, although we do use some Sentinel data in the process, we also draw heavily on the Land Monitoring Service products in order to support the work that we're doing. So we don't start from scratch on everything. We pull in a pre-processed product.
Are you able to give a quick précis of what EU Grassland Watch does? Yeah, I mean, there's clues certainly in the name, maybe.
Now, it's a service to monitor grasslands within Natura 2000 sites, which is the European nature protection sort of network. And the EU realized that although these sites were designated, they couldn't track exactly what was happening in them. For instance, you know, quite rare grasslands would then end up being plowed up and crops planted, etc. And so they wanted some external means of keeping track of what was going on in these sites. So we ran a prototype where we looked at 3,600 of these sites, and we were able to then deliver yearly land cover maps plus additional information on grassland management, grassland productivity, etc., a number of ploughing incidents or, you know, events, etc. But then to put that into a system where the user doesn't have to do any kind of downloading of imagery, they literally click a Let's Explore button, and then you have a kind of a very intuitive map where you can find your site and then click on it, and then it just shows information there. So there's literally no imagery is shown within the product. It's just land cover maps, various indicators, which are then plotted up and summarized in sort of a more useful kind of format.
That sounds fascinating.
I'll come back and talk about that again.
I was going to say, when that project comes to an end. Okay, so the other thing I wanted to bring up, because, again, it's in the Land Monitoring Service, is Eagle. I'll be honest, I only tangentially know what Eagle is. I've come across it so many times, and I've never actually sat down and gone through it properly and worked out what it is. I know that its classification is a lot, like the classes themselves are a lot more involved than most land cover maps. Could you perhaps give an indication of what Eagle is and how it relates again to either Copernicus or to Careen?
Yeah, well, Eagle sort of Eagle is a nested acronym this time, so I won't try. But basically, we're a group of sort of land monitoring experts from across Europe that were actually part of a kind of the people that got sent to the EEA by the European Environment Agency by the member states to make sure that the land monitoring was done how we all wanted it to be done. So kind of an expert advisory group that Eagle came out of. And it's linked to Careen because anyone who's used Careen, it's got 44 classes, but there's lots of land cover and land use mixed into various classes. For instance, there's one called Agriculture with Some Semi-Natural is the class name. But of course, that could mean quite a lot of different things depending on where you are in Europe. And so the idea behind Eagle was how can we both describe these class names, these nomenclatures, and also features on the ground by using quite elementary components. So Eagle has a kind of three block kind of, well, it's not a classification, but it's a description. So we have a land cover block. So that's the actual properties on the surface, and they're hierarchically nested. So we have sort of sealed surfaces, vegetated surfaces, and then water, and then those are then subdivided. But then similarly also for land use, we have a similar breakdown of different land uses, extractive industries, production, residential, etc. And then we have an additional set of characteristics because there are certain properties of the surface that we can't actually describe just with pure land cover and land use. For instance, the arrangement of things and maybe temporal aspects, the phenology, etc., are not always apparent just from the land cover or the land use. And so the idea is then for a particular class, for instance, like one of these classes in Careen, we can then break it down and say, okay, it's made up of these components. So with your agriculture, agriculture with some semi-natural, you would then, you know, it would have herbaceous vegetation characteristics. It would, some of that vegetation would be permanent, some would be temporary if they're crops and they're harvested. The land uses, some of them would be nature protection, some would be agricultural, etc. And are they row crops? Are they irrigated? All these things, but we characterize them so there's a rich description of each of these classes, and we can apply the same description to a feature on the surface. So if we have a patch of land, we can say something about that. And I mean, a good example might be forestry, where its land cover is woody vegetation, which is helpful. And we might be able, from land use, we might be able to say, is it production forestry or is it natural forestry? But then we can add characteristics like tree height, species type, crown cover density, etc., damage, maybe, these sort of characteristics to really describe a surface.
Okay, I'm thinking about a site that's a couple of miles away from where I live, and in the last couple of years, it's started to make a transition from three fields of, I think it was two arable fields and a grassland field, into a rewilded area. So basically, the owner of that farm has put those three fields aside for biodiversity net gain type areas. And I was walking past it the other day, and I was thinking, well, if you hadn't maybe a drone or an aerial camera in an aircraft or something, I could see how you would get land cover out of it, but it's very, very patchy and lots of different land cover types and habitat types within a really small confined area. And I'm guessing from what you've just explained that Eagle would really help with that, because you'd be able to take a sort of a large-ish area on the map and then break down the class into a descriptive sort of representation of what you see there.
Exactly. I mean, because what you find is with various nomenclatures, that's the sort of classes that are in the key, the legend, at the side of a map, you can have a lot of change occurring, but without a change between classes. So if, say, in your case, a grassland, which I assume is scrubbing up over time, that in a land cover sense, it will remain a grassland, but over time, you'll have an increasing amount of tree cover or woody vegetation. So if you separate those two things out, it still remains a grassland, but you can then say, oh, this is becoming you know, more natural, or you have scrub encroachment, whether that's a good thing or a bad thing. But then you can track that rather than suddenly in 20 years' time, it gets reclassified as woodland. And it's like, oh, no, it's too late now. It's all covered in trees or something. So
yeah,
it's a way of kind of managing the landscape a lot more tactically by having these attributes, these descriptors for it.
Yeah. Okay. The other thing that I've come across is Careen Plus. So does that feed into this type of work as well?
Yeah. So Careen Plus, again, came out of the Eagle Group and the kind of Eagle work. And it was because, but going back to this challenge of the original Careen not being able to map detailed information on the surface. But then also knowing that we wanted to keep a lot of this complexity of the Careen nomenclature, so these 44 classes, lots of land use information, particularly in the urban areas. And so in terms of Careen Plus, we actually broke the process down to two parts, where the first is to generate a relatively basic land cover map, but at finer spatial resolution. So now mapping half a hectare objects. So you're now getting down to field sizes or subfield patches and woodland blocks, etc. But then in a simple land cover sense. But then in a separate data set, which we call, that's called CLC Plus Backbone. Okay. Strange naming conventions. But then we have a separate data set called CLC Plus Core, which is actually a 1 hectare grid data set, but it holds a lot of the thematic information, the land use information, the characteristics. So CLC Plus Core has effectively, its data model is the Eagle data model. And the idea then is that if you have a polygon or an object in CLC Plus Backbone, you can then make a call to CLC Plus Core and say, okay, for this area, can you tell me all of the Eagle attributes for it? So again, in your case of grassland, you know, CLC Plus Backbone may continue to map that polygon as grassland, but we can then call the thematic engine, which is CLC Plus Core, and then get it to give us additional information for that area, so the manager or whoever of that location can then operate more effectively, or that regional government can then understand what's happening in their landscape. It's a kind of work in progress, and interestingly, it's raised quite a lot of challenges of what happens to data sets when you take the nomenclature and you break it down into its individual components and then try to recombine them later. It's something that almost you have to try it and find out what the problems are before you can. So lots of things that we didn't anticipate are popping up, but also much more powerful things, such as if you want to do an indicator for the whole of Europe, for instance, that you don't have to generate a land cover map you can actually go to this CLC Plus Core dataset and ask quite precise questions of these attributes. For instance, what area of Europe is irrigated, for instance, which would be phenomenally difficult even with national land cover maps, but if your irrigation information has been picked up and stored at these 1 hectare grids, you can ask quite precise questions rather than having to reinterpret, you know, oh, this bit of agricultural land here, do you think it was irrigated, you know, that. Because that's what happens, because the information gets encapsulated in a land cover class, but then how do you, well, you don't unencapsulate it because it's effectively gone. So but that's what we've tried to break, that cycle. And so I think over the next 5-10 years, I think some really interesting work will come out of CLC Plus Core in terms of how we ask questions of the environment or the information we hold on the environment. We are very map oriented.
Yes, I
was always trying to break the paper map mentality, but I think there's even a slightly geospatial mentality that maybe we not break it, but kind of adapt it and ask it questions in a much more human centric way.
I posted something on LinkedIn recently where, someone I was speaking to who's not in Earth observation at all, not even in geospatial, but they wanted to know what the length of hedgerow was in their, I don't know, it was like a couple of kilometers by a couple of kilometers type of site. But they wanted to know the length of hedgerow, the number of standard trees, and whether or not the health of the hedgerow changed over a 3-year period. And I mean, there's lots of ways you could go about doing that from first principles, and you could, and lots of different data sets you could get. But it sounds like, maybe not that specific example, but it sounds like the process you've just outlined has the ability to answer some of those questions at least, or to start collecting the right sorts of information that would go into creating a database behind the mapping units that then allow those questions to be answered.
Yes, yeah, definitely. And that's exactly those sorts of questions that were asked of, you know, people said to them, look, here's the Karine map. Can you tell me, like, I don't know, how many forest clearings there are in this area and stuff? But it's all been mapped as forests. So it's not, you know, there may be clearings in there, but clearing is in the definition of woodland. So it kind of disappears. These things disappear. And that's just an artifact of, you know, it's not a problem with the product. It's just the way we map the landscape. And we map it by creating classes and then saying certain things are in and out of classes thematically, but also spatially. If they're too small, they have to be generalized out and incorporated into an adjoining class, and then, you know, then we lose information. So we're trying to keep as much of that information and keep it accessible as possible.
Okay. So I guess, given the way that modern society is going, the big question is there a role for AI here? Can't we just embed ChatGPT into the background of this somehow?
Well, interestingly, I mean, embedding ChatGPT in the foreground has been, so we take these questions and then use ChatGPT or some other kind of AI approach to then break them down into what kind of questions we then ask of the databases. Because a lot of these things, they come from policy and politicians, you know, I want to know what's changed in my region type thing. But then how do you then interpret that question and then interpret it, change it into a database query or something? So I think that there's definitely a role there, and again, that's something we're kind of starting to explore right now. But in terms of generating the maps, I think the challenge we find with using artificial intelligence for mapping the landscape is that it's so variable that the characteristics that the AI is looking for, the spectral spatial patterns, they kind of don't repeat in the landscape as much as people would imagine. That, I mean, if you're in the Midwest of the US, then, you know, maybe your fields are square or circular when they're pivot irrigated, etc. But if you look at the UK landscape, and especially going into Southern and Eastern Europe, you mean, you literally will have fields that are, you know, 5 meters wide and 100 meters long, etc. And other fields will be completely different shapes, or they will follow the patterns of the contours, or, you know, these types of things. So it's very difficult then to train these models then to deliver the sort of accuracy that you get from a human interpreted Karine map, because that's effectively how a majority of Karine is interpreted. And I think when you think about, you know, there are global land cover maps being produced at the moment by AI, but they're, their nomenclatures are very limited and not very well described, to be quite frank. And so they're falling into the same traps that we kind of fell into with Karine, really. You know, if you have, imagine trying to describe the world in 9 classes. Well, there's quite a lot going on in the world. To fit, to then hammer it all into 9 pigeonholes, you know, if you then had to divide it out. And that's the problem, you know, in Europe we have 44 classes for Karine, and that is still not good enough. If you were to subdivide out all the different landscape types and biogeographical variants of these different classes.
Yeah, no, that's it really shows the scale of the problem, I guess, and also the ways that it's being addressed by sort of well thought through science to get to an endpoint where the users have an option to look at different types of data sets as well.
One thing I would add, though, just to this the AI discussion, is the fact that I think there is a massive role for it, but not mapping the land cover classes that we expect to find in a map, but to map these things like the eagle elements. Pulling out those basic properties of the surface, the things that do repeat, you know, sort of vegetation behavior over time. Might tell you it's a grassland or something, or it's managed in a certain way. That, to me, that is the exact sort of spatio-temporal pattern identification that AI would excel at, you know, but it probably doesn't make the sexiest products, you know, if you then have to promote them or get VC capital in, you know, VC funding into to actually produce them. So, but I think, you know, because a lot we found with this EU grassland project is there's so much data that we have to push through the back office effectively that's what you need to automate, is all that stuff going on in the background. And then to get it down to a level of information which then other people or other applications can then build on. So there's a challenge there.
Definitely. It's been fascinating talking to you about this. It's really good to get back into land cover stuff. How can people get hold of you if they want to find out more?
Hopefully you'll put my kind of LinkedIn and email, etc., in the show notes. If you follow me on Twitter, apologies for the politics and football that you might also find on my thread, but mostly it's environmental and satellite and Copernicus related stuff. So have a look in the show notes, and please get in touch if you're interested in any of these things. I mean, the UK is in a slightly unusual position at the moment due to something called Brexit. So we've rejoined Copernicus, which is great, but we've not rejoined the European Environment Agency. So that makes a kind of, European Environment Agency is the entrusted entity for the Copernicus Land Monitoring Service. So they head up that. So we're almost part of a program without having a seat at the table. But anyone Brilliant. Who's interested in any of those activities, if you don't know who to speak to, then please feel free to drop me a line and I can point you to the right people or, you know, suggest where to write a letter.
That's brilliant. Thanks very much, Jeff. That's great. And I'll be in touch soon.
Thank you. Bye now.
Thanks for joining us today on the GeoMob podcast. We hope you enjoyed the discussion. You can get the show notes over on the website, which is at thegeomob.com. While you're there, you can sign up for our monthly newsletter and find links to our accounts on Mastodon and LinkedIn, so that you can stay up to date on all our upcoming events. Hope to see you at an event soon.